Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to the first show of the second season of Radio Cherry Bomb. Welcome to our new time slot, Mondays at 1 o'clock. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and I'm coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And on the air every week, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. Our first season is archived on heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes, and you can listen to new shows live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download them anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'll be joined by the wonderful Amanda Cohen, the chef and owner of Dirt Candy, an award-winning, I'm talking Michelin stars, New York Times stars, those kinds of things, the vegetable-driven restaurant in New York City. In addition, she's the author of Dirt Candy, a cookbook, the first graphic novel cookbook published in North America. And Amanda also writes a column for Eater called Dispatches from Dirt Candy, where she explores the realities of working in the restaurant industry. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited you're here. I really think you're one of the most important voices in the food industry right now, and it's great to have you on the show. And I love reading and hearing whatever it is you have to say. So today the whole show belongs to you. You're our only guest, and I'm going to do my best to let you do all the talking. So
okay.
That's my goal. For listeners who might not be familiar with you and your work, I was hoping we could do a little quick sort of bio rundown. So where are you from originally?
I am from Canada. I was born in Ottawa, but I grew up in Toronto.
I've been working with Jessamine Rodriguez, who runs Hot Bread Kitchen.
I love her.
Who's a Toronto native.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm starting to think all the like great women in food come from Toronto. There should be a little like
community.
Yeah,
I know,
a subset of like the Tokla Society or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. I've never met her, but I think what she does is amazing.
She's awesome.
She makes me feel bad.
I'm sure she would feel good / bad to hear that. And when did you get into cooking?
I don't know. This is a long fight that's happened in my family. I swear it's because my mother stopped cooking when I was 13 and I had to feed myself. She does not like that version of the story. But that is the true story. I came from a big family. I have four older siblings. My mother cooked dinner for us every single night. And then when the sister closest in age to me left home, my mom was kind of like, I'm done. I'm done. Like, I've cooked meals for, you know, basically the last 20 years. I'm over it. So it really was feed myself and learn how to cook or eat, I don't know, leftover pasta salad from the night before, which was usually a soup from the night before that and was probably a salad. Yeah, and might have come out of the freezer. And I just started really liking it. And my next door neighbor really loved to cook too. And the two of us would get together after school every afternoon, and we try to think up recipes we could make over the weekend, and it just sort of blossomed from there.
What's your mom's version of the story?
My mother's version is that she taught me how to cook, and that I took those lessons.
You guys were wearing matching aprons.
Yeah, exactly. And she taught me how to bake, and she taught me how to do all these things, and that I took that passion that she instilled in me and went with it. But what she did, that's not the true story, but what she did instill in me is a passion for food. My family loved food, so I do owe them that.
And let's talk about opening a vegetarian restaurant. The road to Dirt Candy, you worked on a lot of some vegetarian restaurants.
Yeah.
I know you worked at Angelica's Kitchen,
yes.
A few other places like that. Have you always been vegetarian focused?
Yeah, well, when I was 15, I became a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And I sort of stayed vegetarian for about 15 years. And when I went to cooking school, I was vegetarian. And I tried as much as possible to only work in vegetarian restaurants. It wasn't always easy. And I did work in a bunch of other kinds of restaurants. But I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And even as I opened Dirt Candy, I was no longer vegetarian. But I thought that there was this need, and not so much for a vegetarian restaurant, but for a vegetable restaurant. Really, there was nothing like that out there. And I figured I could fill a little niche.
And how would you describe the difference between Dirt Candy and sort of old school style vegetarian restaurants?
I think that we don't really have a philosophy behind what we do. We don't have, it's not a lifestyle restaurant. I really, and it's so hard to explain this to people and get them to understand. I don't care what you had for lunch. You don't have to tell me that you're a carnivore when you come to the restaurant. And I don't care what you eat tomorrow. I just really want you to like the food that I'm serving. And I think at other vegetarian restaurants, and there's some great vegetarian restaurants out there, it really is more of a lifestyle restaurant. You know, this is all I can eat. This is what I feel comfortable eating.
And I feel like everyone at places like Angelica, like when I've eaten there, and I love it there, yeah. And I eat everything. I always feel like I'm looking around, I'm like, did they all just go to yoga together?
Exactly.
Like, did I miss that part? Like,
nobody who works at my restaurant does yoga.
That's so funny. So what do you eat currently? Are you a vegetarian? I think you eat fish, is that right?
I eat fish, and if I'm drunk enough, I'll pretty much eat anything. I'm a drunkitarian.
The title of your next book. That's pretty great. No, I think it's kind of like, it's almost, we were talking a little bit before the show about sort of like the gender food issue and talking about like female chefs. And like, I always go back to the like someone, like I would refer to you as a great chef, not a great female chef.
Right.
Like, I don't think, so I think just like your restaurant, like it's a great restaurant. It's not just a great vegetarian restaurant. So.
Right. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of with Dirt Candy. It's that we've really sort of gone beyond the boundaries of vegetarian restaurants. And people do just think of us as a normal restaurant, you know, they're just coming to see what it's all about versus being like, ooh, I'm on a diet today.
Yeah. When did you open Dirt Candy?
October 2008.
And so you ran it from a space on East 9th Street for 6 years.
Exactly.
And you're currently in transition to a larger space.
Yes, I am making the second stupidest decision of my life. The first was opening the original Dirt Candy. And the new decision is that we're going to open a much, much bigger restaurant.
That's pretty exciting.
It is.
And when will those doors, do you think they might open?
Well, realistically, probably the end of November. Hopefully, maybe a little bit
like
sooner.
Post-turkey.
Post-turkey, exactly. When everybody actually wants some vegetables, if I time it just perfectly enough. There's still a bunch of factors up in the air, like, am I going to have gas? Am I not going to have gas? But if everything goes okay, then somewhere around then.
Yeah. So you've got a couple months of this kind of transition.
Yes.
And the new restaurant is going to be on the sort of border of the Lower East Side in Chinatown, is that right?
Yeah, it's on Allen Street at Broome, so it really is that Allen, I think, really divides the Lower East Side from Chinatown. You can see it on the street. On one side, there's like cool, funky little places happening, and then on the other, it's still that neon store after store of Chinese, I don't know, furnishings and glass.
Lots of great greens.
Lots of great greens. I'm so excited. There's a whole new like world of produce.
Yeah,
I'm going to be able to explore and
I'll
run.
I'm so curious if it changes your menu at all.
I think it will. Like, most of our menu was based on what we could get at the corner deli, in case we ran out.
Sounds like an episode of like Top Chef.
Pretty much every night was like Top Chef, and so now I can have, you know, just at least a bigger deli.
That's so funny. A larger bodega. I think what you created when you started Dirt Candy and what you've maintained and established over the last 6 years and what you're about to continue in this new space has been very much sort of the harbinger of like a big thing that's happening right now. And these sort of quote unquote modern vegetarian restaurants are a real, I guess, call them a trend. I feel like every list of cool things happening in New York food right now, there's vegetables on the list somewhere towards the top most of the time. I think this is a great thing.
Yeah.
I know Jean George is planning a vegetarian restaurant in
My main competition.
That's so funny. The Teresi guys, I think they just opened their sort of vegetable-driven place on the High Line. You're going to be near the Fat Radish guys. We were just talking about them, who are on Orchard Street, who their restaurant is not vegetarian, but very vegetable-driven. How do you feel about being sort of one of the kickstarters of this movement? Do you even consider yourself one? Or
I don't, but when other people say it, I feel really good.
I'm going to call you one,
okay,
so you
thanks.
Can just go with that.
No, I mean, I think it feels really good, and I do think in a way people saw that what we were able to do and, you know, how hard it was to get a reservation and how much sort of success we had and how much publicity we got out of it. And I do think they took that and were like, wow, this is something that I've always wanted to do too. And I've been a little afraid and now I can do it. I just hope it, with all these other places opening, people still remember us as the original. Like, I'm the original deep dish pie.
You're the Geno's East of vegetarian cooking. That's so funny. I want to talk a little bit more about the Old Space because it was so, there was a lot that made it quite special, mostly its size or sort of lack thereof. How big was Little Dirt Candy?
Little Dirt Candy was 350 square feet.
In total?
In total, plus a 50 square foot basement, I guess.
And what happened in the 50 square feet? Is that storage or was
that?
It was
storage. There was some making out. It was, surprisingly. When you can catch two of your employees making out in that basement, you're like, wow, don't do it anywhere.
How do you feel in that moment? Is that terrible?
I feel proud, like I'm closing the grate and hoping they didn't see me. A little proud.
That's so funny. And how many seats were in Little Dirt Candy?
Little Dirt Candy was 18 seats, although we were pretty good at squishing in about 23 at a time.
Someone's lap.
Pretty much. What we
like. You count those two in the basement.
It was always sad because we have, you know, the tables for two that we would squish a third at. And then I understand why people did this, but they'd be like, oh, we're three. It won't be a big deal if we come with a fourth. Why wouldn't we be able to come with a fourth? And they'd come with a fourth and we'd be like, no, it's just a table for three.
There just isn't more space.
There just isn't. Yeah. You can't sit at that table. And you could see their faces being like, I don't understand.
So what would you do in that moment when four people show up for a three-person reservation?
First, I would have a heart attack because I was sure that I screwed up the reservation. And then we just have to tell them we're, you know, there's nothing we can do. And they would, in most of the time, they would understand. And sometimes they would eat in shifts. We had that happen.
Do you send like two to a bar or something?
Yeah, and then that's the other two will be like, well, you have 2 hours. Figure it out.
Compare notes later. Yeah.
And then every once in a while, we could actually reconfigure the table so that we would put four people at the table for two. It was awful. And then otherwise, one of them would just have to leave.
It's sort of like, I think these logistics are like the reality of running a restaurant anywhere, but especially in New York where space is so limited.
Yeah, and it's hard for people to understand it. One of the biggest things that would happen is people would come in the restaurant, and I know it seems crazy, and I've done it too, where the hostess, me, would, you know, shows you to your seat and you're at the worst seat that you can possibly imagine in this 9-table restaurant. I was always like, they're all awful. What's your problem? But they'd be like, oh, can we sit at that table? And the restaurant's empty. And you're like, I'm so sorry. I know it seems crazy, but actually I can't sit with that table.
There
is a plan. And then they would get so angry and they wouldn't understand it. And I try to show them like the board we draw out where everybody's sitting every night. And I'd be like, see, you're here and you're a 5:30 table, and then I'm going to put another 5:30 table right next to you, and you're going to come back together for a 7:30 table, and I can't put you at that table because it's a 6 o'clock table. And finally they'd just be like, I'm bored.
That's so funny. So you are pretty transparent when you are explaining things. And
yeah, I mean, what's the point?
Yeah,
you know, like, you can see it, you can see everything that's happening in the kitchen. And I think it's nice, not in all restaurants, when I go out to a really fancy meal, I want that fourth wall there. I don't really want to know everything that's happening.
Sort of leaves a little bit more magic.
Yeah, those restaurants should be magical. 350 square feet, there is no magic. You can see it all. And I think it also allows people to ask more questions, allows them to feel more participatory. Like, if you know why you're sitting somewhere in a restaurant, why you're at the table by the bathroom, it's not because you're ugly. We don't know what you look like before you walk in. So it has nothing to do with your looks. Then you kind of feel more comfortable. You feel a part of the process.
I'm sure there's sort of that feeling of being a little bit in the know. And like, I always feel like if I walk into a restaurant, there's a hostess stand there. It's like, it's this wall. I'm like, what's in your little notebook? Like, what are you writing down? And like, so if you just basically take that notebook and show it to me, I'm like, oh my God, like I feel like in the know. That's great. I want to talk a little bit more about the logistics of that really small space before we talk about the bigger space you're about to move into. How much space was devoted to the kitchen?
About maybe 75 square feet.
Wow.
It was small, but it was actually really manageable.
Yeah.
So, and maybe it's sort of like, I got used to it. So it's like Stockholm Syndrome. My oppressor is now who I relate to. I don't know. We all kind of, we figured it out. And actually having the big space now to us seems really intimidating. We're like, oh, we're just going to be messy. It's more space to spread.
Yeah, I personally love a small kitchen, but I'm cooking in a kitchen by myself, right. So it's easy for me to say that. But I think it's a much more efficient way to work when you're not having to walk around some big island to get to the trash can or whatever.
Well, exactly. And you have in the kitchen what you need, and you use it, and you don't have, like, an excess of pots, and you figure out that you have to wash everything right away, and your kitchen stays neat as you go along. And so, you know, I just see us in our new kitchen being like, let's spread.
I feel like your next move could be like cooking on boats or, yeah. or planes. Or
I'd be so good on a plane.
You could have all the like private jet catering, and that was, you know, not a bad idea. And is it true that in Little Dirt Camp you had no gas? Is that right?
For the first 6 months, okay. I didn't have gas. And then we, the city broke open the street. It was the most exciting day. Like, all these trucks were there, and, like, gravel was flying everywhere. And they put in a line, and we had gas. And our restaurant became normal overnight. But for the day we opened, we didn't have gas.
And I know you were just saying earlier in the new space, you're sort of figuring that all out
now. Yeah, my old enemy, gas.
Yeah. Are you pro-gas? Or are you anti-gas?
Right now I'm a little anti-gas because it's very difficult, and I should have gone with electric. but everything runs better, and it's actually cheaper in the long run. And
To use gas.
So I'm sort of, and it's too late now. The restaurant is about two-thirds of the way being built, and so it's too late to turn back, so I need to get that gas turned on. Does anybody know anybody in Con Edison?
You never know.
I know.
If you're listening,
call me.
What's your Twitter handle?
At Dirt Candy, yep. NYC.
Perfect, Con Ed.
Yeah.
And with that small space, I want to ask you how it sort of worked, because I know you've talked pretty openly about this, especially like in your Eater column, about different things in the restaurant industry. How did it work financially, having that small of a space? Because you can only have so many customers right. a night.
It didn't work, actually. And I do talk about it so much, and I always have these chefs come up to me and like, you have my dream, you have this little restaurant, and you talk to your customers every night, and it's great. And I'm like, right, until you get successful.
So it's sort of more romantic and
such
theory.
A romantic yeah. notion, and it so doesn't work out in reality. So when we took the space, we did fine. The Little Dirt Candy never made money. It never lost money.
That's more than a lot of restaurants.
I know, we're lucky.
That's pretty great. Yeah.
And when we first opened, we could pay our rent, and that's fine. And sort of the way I was taught to figure it out is that in one night, like one weekend night, you make your rent. And the problem is that I could do that at the beginning, and by the end, my rent had gone up. It's the East Village. Rents always go up. And you also have, like, your real estate taxes, and that costs a lot of money, and so you have to figure that in. I couldn't make my rent anymore in one night. No, it's fine. I was making enough. But prices haven't gone up enough. So I'm not charging more to make that rent. And that's a problem in a small space.
And especially when you can't fit that extra fourth or fifth or sixth person.
Exactly.
In.
You know, some nights we would, and we were so lucky, Dirt Candy. So technically I'm only supposed to seat 54 people a night. That should be my maximum. And we were doing nights where we were doing 65, sometimes a little bit more. We were turning the tables more than three times. But it wasn't always the most enjoyable nights. It was too frantic. And when you feel this pressure to make money like that, like, I have to do it, I have to do it, I have to pay my staff, it makes the whole process not fun. And with the sort of success that we had, I had to hire a lot more staff. Mm. And it doesn't equal out. So when I opened, I only had three people on staff. By the time we closed, I was at eight. And the numbers just never matched up. And part of the problem, too, with when you get really successful is you have to hire so many more people to do things for you if you want to have other time. Like, I never had time to be in the kitchen to create dishes, or not enough time, because I was always answering the phone. I was always doing the reservations.
Sort of running the show.
Yeah, QuickBooks, serving tables, all that stuff takes up so much time, and you don't think about it when you open. And those first couple of months, even that first year, you're like, it's not so bad. I'm only calling 20 people back. But by the end, you're like calling, you know, at least 30 tables for reservations, and then you're calling the next day's tables and the days in advance, like the day after that, just to see if they're still coming, because, you know, no shows, big problem. And all that sucks up all your time. So the joy of having this tiny little restaurant where you get to know your staff, you get to know all your customers, and you're cooking in the kitchen every night, it doesn't work.
It's that, like, romantic novel version of being that small town.
Yeah, it's like the Harlequin horror. Yeah.
And so in all this experience and going through that and the financial aspects of that and these sort of issues that come with being successful, which are definitely good issues, but issues nonetheless.
Good issues. I mean, can't complain.
Yeah. You have chosen to go to a bigger space.
Yes, because I'm an idiot.
But I think that's a great decision. Like, what would the alternative be? Just to not have a restaurant? Or
yeah.
That sounds really good right
that
now.
That sounds really good. I've had a week off. I'm like, oh, this is like normal people. This is so much fun.
You're here at Roberto's at 1 o'clock. You're hanging out.
Exactly. I had like cocktails on my balcony at 5 o'clock yesterday. Who does that? Normal people do that.
That was what you were saying right before you came on. I thought it was so great about, I guess you were like calling friends and saying like, I have 3 nights in a row. Like, do you want to hang out?
And they're like, no, it's like a weeknight. I'm like, no, but you know, like it's 3 nights and it's so exciting. And they're like, no, you're going to be bored soon. I'm like, I'm never going to be bored. I have so much to do.
We had Missy Robbins on, I guess it was a few weeks ago, along with Laura Manick, who runs Cork Buzz, and Missy's now doing some cooking there. And Missy's taken, without quite planning to take this long, but has taken like a year off, and she is so happy. It was so great to talk to her and to see her just really enjoying that time off. And we had a really great discussion about the importance of taking some time and taking time in between projects. And then Marissa Lippert was on another show. She runs Nourish Kitchen and Table, and she was talking about the importance of, before you start a new thing, making sure it's not just financed, but well-financed, and all the time it takes to really start something new, even if it's a new version of an old thing.
Well, yeah, and to be better organized, and that's something that I've really realized in this like week. It feels very Oprah-like. I'm like, wow, time for myself, it's amazing. And you know, it's funny, things like, I swear there might have been a bra or two in my drawer that I hadn't washed in 6 years. Like, I have time to do this. Oh my gosh, I don't have pressure to get somewhere. Like, I finally feel relaxed. I'm like, I need to figure out how I can do this in the new space.
To carry this with you.
Yeah, because it, you know, like every day I'd wake up and I'd feel like I was late. I might wake up at 7 in the morning. It's, you know, and I'd get home around 11 or 12. And this pressure to always feel like I'm not busy enough, I'm not doing enough. That's something I have to figure out.
And so is that something you're sort of consciously working on before the next space opens? Or you're talking about it?
I'm talking about it. I'm going to talk about it a lot.
You're going to have more staff in the new place. It's going to be a bigger space.
Yeah. So I think the new space is going to have a whole new set of headaches. But they'll be different headaches. And they're headaches that I think I know how to deal with a little bit better now. You know, when we opened, it really was just me and my staff. And as we've grown, I have so much more help. So even the first year of Dirt Candy, I was exhausted from opening it. And now I have staff who can do all the stuff that I was doing at the beginning while we were opening it. Like, just even like going to the Bowery and picking up all the stuff that we forgot to pick up. You know, like, I don't know, tongs. You know, like, somebody else can run out and do that. And I'll have the reservationist, and I'll have somebody who sort of like can be an administrator and manager, and somebody who can hire. And all that fell on my shoulders at the beginning of Dirt Candy. And I really feel like, in the past week, it's the first time I've let go of all that stress from 6 years ago. And knowing that I'm going into the new Dirt Candy with all this extra help is huge.
That's amazing. And I think it really speaks to, I think we talk a lot about, we have on the show, but just in life in general, about what it takes to become successful. And you need so much energy to make that kind of success happen the way you really made it happen at Little Dirt Candy. But then to take that step to make it a more sustainable life, to make it a place you're happy to go to every day. And, you know, so you have a life that you're well rested and all those things. To take those steps requires such a different set of skills that come past just making it, you know, successful and well regarded and all that.
And that's the learning curve with the new one. You know, when I opened Dirt Candy, I wasn't confident in my cooking, and I wasn't sure anybody was ever going to come to the restaurant. And I feel like a little bit more solid in that regard.
As you should, for sure. Yeah. And I can say that.
And so for me, the learning curve really is going to be, how do I make this function? I have the lease for 12 years. I can't end up at the end of 12 years being like, ooh, I haven't washed my bras in 12 years. Like, that's just gross.
We're going to get you a gift certificate to, like, Tournelle or something. Just get new ones. Don't wash them. That's so funny. On that note, we're going to take a really quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about your book and also about tipping.
Okay.
All right.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Seeing a need to help people sort through all the misinformation about healthy eating, Whole Foods Market added a 7th core value: to promote the health of our stakeholders through healthy eating education. In our stores, we give you the tools you need for choosing the most nutritious foods and healthy recipes, as well as offering classes with nutritionists and cooking coaches to help inspire good health and well-being. Stop by your local store today and learn more about our Health Starts Here program and wellness clubs, or online at wholefoodsmarket.com/healthstartshere.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and we're back with Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy. We were just talking all about Little Dirt Candy, your
right.
former restaurant, and you're about to move to Big Dirt Candy. It'll still just be called Dirt
Candy. It'll still be just called Dirt Candy.
But I want to talk about some other projects that you've done and are currently doing. So to start with, your cookbook, which is, I think, insanely amazing. Your
Thank
cookbook
you.
Is a graphic novel, which I devour cookbooks and have for years. I had never seen that before. What gave you the idea to do your book in such an unexpected way?
Well, I knew I didn't want to do a regular cookbook. I didn't think that was going to be fair to Dirt Candy and what we had started to build. Like, Dirt Candy was always so different, and I feel like people kept expecting us to do more and more different things. So if I did a regular cookbook, which I love, by the way, it wouldn't have fit in with our personality. Because, you know, restaurants have personalities, and ours is very strange and weird and kooky and fun.
Do you feel like the Dirt Candy personality and your personality, are they one and the same? Are they very different? Or
they're probably exactly alike, but I don't want to admit it.
That's so funny.
Although that's been, you know, sometimes I'm like, I'm not Dirt Candy. I'm not Dirt Candy. I'm totally Dirt Candy. I had been approached a couple of times by different editors saying, you know, we want to do a cookbook with you. We want to do a cookbook with you. And I was like, I don't know. It's not time. And I also, particularly for us, when they were approaching us, was within the first year. And I was like, it's too soon. It's too yeah. soon. We don't have any stories to tell. And, you know, I have to focus on the restaurant. It's barely working. And then it sort of kept happening, and we got a little bit more settled, and sort of, I don't know, I had this idea. I was like, it's now or never. It's now or never. I have to do it, which is probably the worst thing to think.
But also kind of the only way to get something like that done
yeah, exactly.
is to feel like, I think you have to trust that sort of intuition moment. Because that's I know firsthand, it's daunting to do a cookbook and to complete
it. It's crazy. I can't believe you do that all the time. All those
But I'm not
recipes.
Also running a restaurant
I know,
or
but,
you know, anything like that.
Oh, my goodness. I think it was actually the hardest part of Little Dirt Candy, those 2 years when we were working on it.
Book.
Yeah. And then I was actually having a conversation, or one could call it a fight, with my husband. And we were talking about the cookbook and what we want to do. And I was like, I really want to make it different. And I don't know. And he's like, you can't always be different. And I was like, no, we have to. And he sort of screamed at me. He was like, well, you should just make it a graphic novel cookbook. And I screamed back at him, I hate you. That's the best idea. At this point, we were on like opposite ends of the street. And we both actually kind of stopped. And we were like, wow.
Not that's a bad idea.
Really could be something great. And then we went back to all the editors who had approached us. And they were like, nope, not going to do that.
So people, editors and publishers had yeah. approached you about a book, and then you went back to them with this idea.
Yeah, with this idea, with little mock-ups, and they're like, it's never going to work. And so, other people had tried and had mm-hmm. sort of failed, and they were like, it's too much work.
And how come yours didn't fail?
I don't know. We're still not sure. I think, one, we had an established voice. Mm-hmm. So I do think the fact that we were a restaurant and people knew what we wanted to do, we had that built-in audience.
And you've also, did you start blogging for the restaurant's website when you started?
Cause, yeah.
Yeah, because I've always thought of you as sort of restaurateur slash sort of blogger, writer.
Right.
So I'm sure that sort of came in handy, that you had an established writing voice.
Exactly. And we had the blog, and we knew people were coming to the blog every day. And then we got an amazing artist. Who?
Yeah, I was going to ask about who did you work with on
so
the book?
His name is Ryan Dunleavy, and he has done a lot of things, but he's probably most well known for a book he's done called Action Philosophers, which if you ever want to know anything about philosophers, it will tell you everything in the most amazing way, and you'll come out of being like, wow, I remember this so much more than my college course, Philosophy 101. It's very brilliant. And sort of, I think, with his following and his amazing art and sort of our vision, it came together, and it seemed like it could
yeah.
work, you know.
And you found him, or he found you?
my husband knew him, and he had asked him for recommendations for somebody to do this. And Ryan was like, well, I would really like to do it. It's something I've always been interested in. And my husband was like, really? We didn't think you'd ever want to do it. I think you're going to be way too expensive for us. He's like, no, I come cheap. And he did.
That's great. Yeah, that's so amazing. I think that's a big, like, can't hurt to ask. And, like, you never know what, like,
you never
even
know.
If you're just asking someone for a recommendation, but it turns out to be them. Or
and he wanted to do it, and he was excited to do it, and it was good because
that makes all the difference.
It does, and his art really sort of worked with what we wanted to do. It has a sense of fun. It's not serious.
And how did that process work? Did you write a manuscript and then give it to him, or did you do it sort of more in tandem? Or
we sat down for a week and sort of every day worked through what we wanted to do. And then none of that actually happened. But we had
that's
a
always
basic idea,
like,
right?
When I work with people on their books, I feel like it is something I should say more out loud, but it's like the first stuff that we do is
never gonna make it.
But you have to do that to get to the stuff that will make
you
it.
You do, and you have to do it to get to know each other too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which basically we went on vacation together for a week. And then we sort of did a manuscript, and my husband's an actual writer. It's what he does by profession. I'm a cook. And he was very familiar with, like, writing a screenplay and writing out descriptions and all that kind of stuff. And that's basically how you do it. And he would write something down. We would have a discussion. He would write it down. It would go to Ryan, and it would come back and be like, oh my gosh, this is actually working. It looks exactly like what you wrote it. And Ryan would have changed a little, so it looked better. And it was great. I mean, seeing those pages come day after day.
It must have been so exciting.
Yeah.
Sounds like the right team in place. And
it was a great team. And I had to let go. I thought I was going to look like Superwoman. And the first pictures came back, and I was like, that doesn't look exactly like Superwoman. And they were both like, shut up. I was like, okay.
It's hysterical. There's always another book if you want. I want to talk a little bit about the recipes that are in the book, because I really love that you didn't sort of dumb things down for
really,
the
I
reader.
I appreciate that. Thank
yeah.
you.
Oh, no, big time. I think there's so many sort of like modernist techniques in the book. And I think that, I mean, at least I believe the following is true, and I also very much hope it's true, that I think a lot of people who are buying cookbooks these days are so, like, you know, I think having to put everything in, like, 4 ingredients or 20 minutes or that. I mean, like, I get that. I appreciate it. Like, you know, I want to cook quickly sometimes, too. But, like, there are savvy cooks and savvy readers. And I think that you really approached a really smart audience. And I think that's why it was so well received, in my opinion. I want to talk a little bit about the techniques, these sort of quote-unquote modernist cooking techniques. Are these things that you, how did you learn them? Did you teach yourself? Did someone else teach you?
I taught them myself from the internet.
From the internet.
You know, we would have an idea and be like, let's figure it out. And then we would spend days, like, researching
like
the
YouTube
internet.
YouTube videos
yeah,
and stuff like
pretty
that.
Pretty much. That's how we learned how to make the caviar pearls. everything. How we make the dumplings. YouTube video.
And how do you make them? Just to describe, like, one of these techniques.
With the caviar, you know, you take basically 2 chemicals, calcium chloride and sodium alginate, and they both get, the calcium chloride gets mixed with water, and the sodium alginate gets mixed with, the last time we did it was with the tomato juice, and you let them sit for a day. And they don't call it blending in modernist cuisine. It's called shearing. It's totally blending, though. I don't know why. We kept being like, what's the shearing thing? And we're like, oh, they just mean pour it in the blender. And then you drop the tomato solution into the water solution, and the pearls will form. And you pull them out. Yeah, it's pretty easy.
What do you make of the sort of gender issue when it comes to these techniques? Because I've always sort of felt that molecular gastronomy in general and all the techniques that come with it. I once heard a phrase that I thought sort of summed it up perfectly, which was, it's boys with their toys. Do you, as someone who uses these techniques, who wrote about them, you are a woman, what do you feel about all that?
I think it's part of a bigger issue. I think everybody, given the opportunity, would love to play with them and love to figure it out and not necessarily have whole restaurants, but it's fun having techniques and learning new techniques. For me, my problem was always that I didn't have enough time to learn it. And that's because I run a very small restaurant. And if I had a lot more time, maybe I would do a lot more with it. But, you know, you do have to figure it out. And then once you figure it out, you have to be able to teach it to other people. And then you kind of, by the time you start teaching it to somebody else, I always feel like you really have to understand it so that when they ask you questions, you'd be like, yeah, this is why
it works.
You've
got the answer, yeah.
And as a small restaurateur, I don't have a lot of that time. So this is why I think women don't do it a lot. It's because in general, I think they run smaller restaurants. And they don't have the time to, you know, do all that research. Whereas if you look at the men who are playing around with it, they probably have more financing
they
behind
have more
their
investors,
restaurants.
Yeah.
And they have the time to play around.
I think that's the best sort of explanation of that. And I think you summed up a lot of what's going on in the industry. And, you know, there could be more tomato caviar
everywhere
if we had more investors interested in female restaurateurs. Or not.
I think maybe we would all be like, ooh, we don't want to do this at all.
I think your description of even the process sort of like speaks to a lot of, like even using that word shearing instead of blending. Like, I think to me, there's a lot of like extra vocabulary attached to these things. I think, you know, people wearing, what do you call them? Sort of like lab coats instead
right,
of aprons and stuff like that. Like, to me, it's no different than adding, I don't know, like baking powder to banana bread to get it to rise. It's like the most comforting, like homey thing.
Right, exactly.
Involves an element of chemistry and science. And we've all been doing it. Our mothers, our grandmothers have. So there's nothing new about
all
this.
There's nothing new about it. And almost everything that's added is actually a natural product. So you're not, it's not some weird chemical that a lab made up. Sodium alginate is an actual real product that you find somewhere.
Just hasn't been like branded to
look
like.
Branded, but it is, and I mean, you know, it's in a lot of different foods, and it's in a lot of more commercial foods, let's say. It's not in, you know, a food that you might make at home, but that doesn't make it bad for you. It just makes it different. It is like, it's exactly like a baking powder. Yeah. Somebody had to discover that.
Yeah, totally. Fascinating. speaking of your book and writing, I want to talk a little bit about your eater column.
When did I owe them one. I'm going to be in so much trouble. They're going to hear this and be like, why aren't you at home writing it?
Because you're busy talking about it. That's
I
a good
know.
Thing. You can blame it on me. I love the column that you've been doing. And I think you're just like wonderfully articulate and do a great job at breaking down big issues in the restaurant world. And you make them understandable, not just for people in the industry, but for consumers too, who are also people in the industry.
Right.
How did the column come about?
I think, you know, I had written that piece, the Gods of Food, or Dudes of Food, as I like to call it.
Amanda wrote basically the best rebuttal that I read on the issue about when Time Magazine published their Gods of Food issue, which sort of sparked a huge conversation in the restaurant industry and even beyond. And it basically, make a long story short, kind of like only included men and sort of left women out of the conversation
exactly.
in a big way. And you wrote a great response to it on Eater. So that was the birth of your
That was
column.
The birth of kind of wanting to have a bigger audience than what my blog could allow and doing it on there. And they were really receptive. And I think it also coincided with the time when Eater's changing a little.
Yeah,
you know,
big
they're
time, yeah.
big time. They're going into more like long form pieces. And I think they're less of a gossip site now. And, you know, more of a, hey, we're an industry site and we want people in the industry to read us and appreciate us. And so those two sort of came together. And I know probably with the new restaurant, I'm not going to write the blog as much. But I can probably, although I'm still late right now, you know, do a column every once in a while for Eater and still have opinions. And it's, it's a good way to get my voice out
no,
there.
It's a great platform. And I definitely think Eater is growing and evolving. And as someone who reads all these things, like I've been excited to see that they're including people like you and really giving a platform to great pieces like the ones that you've been writing.
I also hope it means they won't be as mean to me.
That's so funny. That's a pretty smart way to go about, you know, get into bed with your enemy kind of thing. I want to talk about your latest post for a bit because I thought it was amazing, and it is about the issue of tipping.
Yeah.
I've printed it out and I've highlighted it, as you can see. And I kind of just wanted to go through it with you because I think you make like amazing points. And basically the whole argument is that the way that we as consumers pay checks in restaurants and then the tips that come along with those checks is a system that just doesn't work. And it doesn't work for the restaurant, it doesn't work for the servers, it doesn't work for the rest of the staff, and it also doesn't work for the consumer.
It really doesn't. It's a broken system.
Yeah. I want to talk about the reasons you sort of outlined why it doesn't work, because it was pretty eye-opening to me, and then also what your sort of proposed solution is. So some of the reasons it doesn't work. The first point you brought up was that when we go eat at restaurants, most of us I think you said before we even sit down, 9 times out of 10, each of us pretty much tips the same that we tipped last time we went out. So it's sort of this automatic thing. It's like, that it's going to be this. Like,
you're a 15% tipper. You're an 18% tipper. You're a 20% tipper. I mean, something would have to go really, really wrong for you not to tip that amount. I mean, your service would have to be awful, right? It's a fallacy. We all pretend we're going to go out and have this choice, and we don't. We made it, you know, 2 years ago, and we're like, oh, well, now tipping is 18%, not 15%, and you stick with it.
No, it's this moment of, like, this fake feeling of having agency when we're all doing the
same
thing.
How much are you going to leave? Same.
Yeah. I know you mentioned that only twice in the history of Little Dirt Candy, as we call it now, that only twice did customers leave a super low, what you called a punishment tip, so, like, a really low tip.
Yeah.
How often do you see tips above, let's say, like 20%?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
I'm happy to hear that.
People are generous.
Yeah. And so to go back to why the tipping doesn't work, we start with it's unfair to servers. And you said simply and perfectly that if you do a job, you should be paid a fair salary. And so explain to listeners why that doesn't work with the way tips work.
Well, first of all, you never know what you're going to make. So how unfair is that every day you come to work and you're like, I'm going to hustle for my money? Like, even strippers kind of have a better idea. And so that's I just think having that burden the moment you walk in the door and you're like, I'm going to have to work really hard tonight. I'm going to have to, like, you know, I'm not that you shouldn't want to work hard every night, but you shouldn't have to, like, sing for your supper every night, basically. And then in terms of, like, the restaurant, I should be paying my server. You're working for me. You're not working for the customer. I should have the balls to say, this is what the check is, or, you know, this is the service fee, and I'm going to give it to you, my employee. It shouldn't be the customer who's taking on the burden of paying my server's salaries that way.
Absolutely. And then also that affects everyone else who works at the restaurant, because those tips go to the wait staff and not to line cooks, dishwashers, all the other people who sort of make your experience in a restaurant happen.
Well, and this is what I saw at Dirt Candy. And one of the reasons I write these articles is because I want to understand more of what's going on, and I want to change what I do. You know, when a customer would leave a tip at the end of the night for one of my servers, technically it all has to go to her. And I had two servers in general. They were always women. So it has to go to her. But one of the problems is that, and I didn't want the money, but I was actually on the floor the whole time, and they assumed it was going to me too, but I can't take it. I'm the manager, and I don't think managers should take tips. But they assume that the money's going to whoever served them. Half the time, one of my line cooks was bringing out water or hush puppies or clearing the table. The money could never go to them. It has to go.
Legally,
yeah. It has to go to the server. The only people who can make part of the tip money, unless it's worded differently, is the person who has brought you the food. So all that work that happens in the kitchen, they don't get to see the customer's gratitude either. Only the server does.
And I feel like a lot of, and you pointed out this point a lot in the piece, but I think a lot of consumers just assume that waiters are having, like, a lower sort of hourly wage to compensate for the tip they're getting.
Right.
But you broke it down so well, and I'll just send everyone to the article, because I think it's better just to read it, and there's a great chart that outlines it. But just because their hourly wage is lower, what they end up making in tips is so much higher than everyone else, which obviously isn't, like, a bad thing for waiters.
No, it's a great thing.
But it's a broken system for the whole restaurant, and it's not a sustainable way for anyone to continue working.
The system at Dirt Candy, I can basically only pay my line cooks, you know, $13-$15 around there, or anybody who works for me. We tried to even it out so that most people ended up making around $15 an hour. That's not a lot of money. I mean, it's not a lot to live in New York. Yeah. It's almost impossible. That's why we're all losing these cooks. And you know, the big complaint that I hear from every other chef in the city is, and it's my complaint as well, is, like, there's no cooks out there. There's no prep cooks. There's no line cooks. Well, of course there aren't. I couldn't afford to live in this city now. And, you know, my servers, who work so hard and who are amazing, but they are sometimes taking home $40 an hour, $45 an hour.
That difference is huge.
It's huge. And so why, how is this system okay that these people who are there making your food, you know, from some of them get in at 1 and they leave at like 1 a.m., are making like a quarter of the amount of the server who's there for 8 hours, maybe a little bit longer. And as they're both working just as hard, but one of them is getting rewarded so much more.
And your proposed solution, which is happening in some restaurants, is to essentially include the sort of service charge in the check, but distribute it more properly
exactly.
to everyone there.
So at the new Dirt Candy, anything can happen, and maybe I'll fail miserably with this. I'm not planning on having tipping. We've gone back and forth a lot with lawyers and tried to figure out how it could happen. I can just raise the prices across the board, and there's no debate about it. You know, and so for, let's say I have a portobello mousse, and right now it's $15 maybe. Maybe it's $13. I could charge you $18. In the end, it's going to be the same. You would have tipped me $3 on it,
sure,
or $1.50, whatever. But that sticker shock is pretty hard. So, you know, you go and you see your bill at the end, and even though it's the exact same amount you would have paid, I think people will have a lot of problem with that. And we're already all going to have to raise our prices anyways, because, you know, we have to deal with healthcare and sick days. And so what I think everybody should adopt at the moment is an employee appreciation fee, something called that. An employee fee. You can't say server fee. It has to be an employee fee. And then the tip
an
you would
EAF.
Yeah. the tip, that 20% tip or 18% tip, however much you think it's worth, is just automatically included. But you see it. And I think if you see employee tip or employee fee, and then you see how much that $18 is, 20% is, and you look around and you see everybody who it's going to go to, it makes a lot more sense.
And I think it speaks to what you were talking about earlier on the show of just that moment when you are standing behind like the desk at the front, and then you show the notebook and it's like, this is how it works. And this is, and we want it to work for all of us, consumers, like staff, everyone.
Right. Like if I could, I would say, look, this is your portobello mousse and it costs $15, but let me break down what you're really paying for. That's $2 for this dish. And it's going to be $1 for toilet paper because I know you're going to go to the bathroom. I bet you want to eat in light. So you're going to have to pay like 30 cents of my electricity bill. I mean, all these are the true costs.
And you've spoken at length about this on Eater about all these costs, and I'm going to refer everyone to your column because we are sadly just about out of time, and I have a few more questions I want to get to really fast. But I'm so glad that you are our only guest today because I could talk to you all day.
I can go on and on.
So normally we end every segment with the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which is a series of questions we ask every guest, but I am going to just ask you one question, which is my favorite question. And that is, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Wow, that's a tough one. Okay, so this is so sappy. I don't think I had a favorite meal. I loved Sunday nights, and we were Jewish, so we always had Chinese food. That's what you do.
I grew up the same way.
But mostly what I really loved about it was my whole family was there, and my siblings are much, much older. So when I was like 10, two of my siblings were already in college, and then my other two were in like high school, and they were, you know, always out. And so this was this one night that we would all sit down together and have dinner. It would be my mom, my dad, and, you know, me and my four siblings. And just that moment, that's what I loved the most. And the Chinese food was good.
Yeah. Takeout, or you would go to a restaurant?
Takeout.
Takeout. Awesome. Amanda, thank you so much for being here today. Everything about Dirt Candy is online at dirtcandynyc.com.
Yes.
Your book can be purchased through the website or Amazon or indiebound.org, any of those kinds of sites. Your Twitter handle, I think you said it earlier,
it's dirt candy.
NYC.
No, I lied.
Just Dirt Candy. And your column on Eater is called Dispatches from Dirt Candy. I highly recommend it. And a few more announcements before we go. One is about Fed Up, the documentary. And I, along with Carrie and Claudia from Cherry Bomb and so many others, have really been moved by it. It was produced by Lori David and Katie Couric, and directed by Stephanie Sochig. I think I'm saying her name correctly. It's billed as the movie that the food industry doesn't want you to see, and it brings a lot of truth about the way the industry works and the consequences that these decisions and patterns have on our health and culture. I think it's totally important to see, and it's really, really important to talk about. And starting tomorrow, it's available on DVD and for rent on iTunes, which makes it even more easy to watch. And speaking of iTunes, you can subscribe to the Radio Cherry Bomb podcast on iTunes. And speaking of Cherry Bomb, Bomb, the third issue with Ruth Reichel on the cover, is out now, and you can check out cherrybomb.com for subscription information. Those are all my announcements. As always, thank you everyone for listening. I'm so happy to be back with the second season of Radio Cherry Bomb, and we've got great women just like Amanda lined up. I'm really excited to talk to them, and I'm so happy you're listening. I'll talk to you next Monday at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.